Spider-Man and the Wasp.
Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Spider-Man and the Wasp. From Marvel Team Up number 60, cover dated August of 1977. And Shag, we left Yellow Jacket for dead last time, so we need to resolve this.
Do we really, though? I mean, if Yellow Jacket's dead, is that the worst thing that's happened today?
Today in 1977.
Right, 1977.
Well, I don't know if it's the worst thing, but Jan is very much having problems with this. She freaked out at the end of the previous issue, and today not only does she have to come back from that, but she is our lead character. Last time we talked a whole lot about Hank Pym. This episode, we're talking about the Wasp. The focus, the spotlight is on Janet Van Dyne.
Let's be honest, though. Last time, we desperately wanted to talk about Janet Van Dyne, and it was really hard not to.
This time, it's all hers. So I ask you, reasons why we like the guest character. So what's so great about the Wasp that you wanted to talk about her last time, and now you get to do it?
Sure. What's so great about the Wasp? She's awesome. Done. Do I really need to say more?
I think you could.
Of course I have more to say. You've recorded with me before. For me, I first encountered Wasp in Secret Wars, issue number 2 specifically. It was my very first superhero comic as a collector ever. And I preface that by saying superhero comic, not comic in general. But either way, and throughout Secret Wars, like, she's pretty much just there as an object of desire for Magneto and the Lizard. And then she ends up even dying in Secret Wars. But, you know, she gets better. It wasn't necessarily very progressive or, like, representative of the Wasp at that time, especially, I mean, she was the leader of the Avengers. But as a 12-year-old kid, I wasn't thinking about fair representation. And I just thought she was cool. I mean, she stood up to Magneto. She seemed to know how to take care of herself. She even destroyed Ultron, right? She's pretty badass. And then, just kind of through the zeitgeist of being a comics reader and talking with friends, I found out that she was considered by a bunch of people to be the best leader of the Avengers. So, of course, like, okay, mad respect there. And then, pretty much every comic I've read with her, she's incredibly capable. And she's a solid leader. I mean, she's also got the capacity to be sexy and flirty, so, you know, I'm down with that. And the constant costume changes are awesome. And in the 1990s, we even got that transformation into an insect version of Wasp, which I'm that one guy who likes that. It's the sad part, though, is, like, I've read a ton of Avengers comics, and I'm talking in the hundreds, you know? And most of them, she's not on the team of the issues I've read. She just doesn't tend to be around those eras. So when I do run into her, I prefer her solo without Hank. Her and Hank seem to reconcile every few years, and it is kind of sweet, but I still prefer her by herself. I guess the best way to say this is, like, you know, we all have some characters that we just really, really like. And it's probably too much to call them a favorite, because we haven't read all their stories, and we don't know their history backwards and forwards. And yet it doesn't change the fact that we really like that character. And Wasp is just one of those for me. What about for you?
You know, I'd seen her before Secret Wars. Maybe I like a random issue of Avengers. Mm-hmm. And of course, Secret Wars was also one of my key early Marvel comics. So I remember that. I mean, she gets a laser right through the chest at one point and still survives.
Yep.
But really, I got to know her as the Avengers leader in Roger Stern's Avengers. And I loved her in that role. I think, you know, like, she gets a different costume every issue. So I'll pick up on that you mentioned that, because though her costumes are all kind of generic in a way, maybe that's why they never stuck around, you know, or they weren't meant to anyways. But I really like that idea of a fashion designer heroine who makes her own outfits, keeps swishing them out. She must have the biggest superhero walk-in closet in comic book history. Maybe it's not big. Maybe it's, like, tiny and, you know, she just goes in. It's a normal closet, but all the costumes are shrunk. But it's a very unique thing. I can't name any other hero that's kind of like that.
No, I mean, it's definitely her shtick is changing her costume. Absolutely. And I don't know anyone it's got that same shtick down.
She's designing them herself, etc. So to name just one reason why I like the Wasp, I think that to me is what stands out.
Since we're talking about costumes, I do have to shill for my favorite Wasp costume. And it actually did stick around for, I don't know, 5-10 years. It was her costume for a long time in the 2000s. She had a black bodysuit and just segments of almost like armor, really high shine gold plates that were sort of almost like in V shapes going down along the front. And it just looked really cool. And if you know the costume I'm talking about, it being it's in your head. If you don't, I'm not describing it very well. So sorry, folks. But she wore this through a lot of her Avengers run in the 2000s. And she looked great with the high gloss gold and the black bodysuit. Was fantastic.
Let's talk a bit about her publication history. Janet Van Dyne was created by Stan Lee, Ernie Hart, and Jack Kirby for Tales to Astonish number 44, cover dated June of 1963, where she becomes Ant-Man's partner to avenge her father's death. Thereafter, co-starring in Hank Pym's adventures and sometimes in her own backup tales through to 1965. She gets her sting in issue 57 of that book. She was, of course, a founding member of the Avengers, and she's responsible for giving the team its name. She would become, in fact, the Avengers' longest-serving member, despite several leaves of absence, during which she'll guest star in other books in the 60s and 70s. The 70s will also see her get a power boost. But we'll save that for our discussion today. It's about to happen. And of course, events are set in motion in that decade that will lead to her divorce from Hank after he suffers a breakdown. This is a storyline that has Ultron use her as a template for the robotic Avenger Jocasta. Something I admit I'd forgotten all about.
Might be for the best.
What is more remembered from the story is that Hank becomes violent with her, which we discussed at length in our previous episode. But by then, we're in the 80s, which will turn out to be a better decade for Janet. In Avengers 217, she becomes the team's leader. Her term lasts 6 years, from 82 to 87, and is personally responsible for an influx of female Avengers, recruiting She-Hulk and Captain Marvel Monica Rambeau to the team. She'll become a proper fashion designer in this era and play the field with romances with Tony Stark and Paladin, an unrequited one for Black Knight, and only pretends to be seduced by Magneto, yeah, right, during Secret Wars. At the end of the decade, she moves to the West Coast Avengers and leads that team, also rekindling her relationship with Hank for a time, which takes us into the 90s, Shag.
So from 1991 onward, you know, she remains involved in many of Marvel's biggest events, and she underwent several major status quo changes, too. And in the early 1990s, she's considered a prominent member of the Avengers. Although no longer chairman, she does serve as one of the team's most experienced voices, mentoring newer heroes and frequently acting as the Avengers' moral center. During this era, she reconciled with Hank Pym, as you mentioned, and the pair gradually rebuilt their friendship after years of turmoil following their divorce. Now, during the aftermath of the Crossing event in 1996, Janet's body was permanently mutated into an insectoid form. While she was still clearly a human female, she had these insectoid features. And by permanent, I mean it lasted for like 4 months. because, hey, you know, here comes Heroes Reborn. But the cool thing is we still got an action figure out of it. So yes, hey, Heroes Reborn. So 1996 happens again. Onslaught, Heroes Reborn, all that relaunch with Image Comics creators, in which we get a whole new alternate reality Avengers continuity that included Janet Van Dyne. You know, we've forgotten all about the insectoid stuff, never to be seen again. Then a year or so later, she's restored to the Marvel Universe, back to normal. Then in Kurt Busiek and George Perez's beloved Avengers run, she became one of the anchors of the team again. She resumed active duty, rekindling her romance with Hank. That seems to be just a pendulum just going back and forth, her and Hank. And eventually she served as co-leader of the Avengers alongside Captain America. And in the time-crossed Avengers Forever miniseries, one of my absolute favorites, she was selected as the team leader again because she's just that awesome. Now, Janet was gone from the Avengers for quite a long period of time during Bendis' New Avengers era, which is, by the way, one of my core periods of reading the Avengers. So, again, a lot of stories without Janet. And then during Civil War, she supported the Superhuman Registration Act, placing her firmly on Iron Man's side of the conflict. And later, she joined the newly formed Mighty Avengers. Then during Secret Invasion, it's revealed that Hank Pym had been replaced by a Skrull who secretly altered Janet's biology, which ultimately leads to Janet's death. And in the aftermath, Hank Pym takes up the mantle of the Wasp himself. Then in 2012, we learn that Janet actually survived. She was trapped in the Microverse for many years, which sort of parallels what happened to the MCU version of her as well. And she was rescued by the Avengers. Since then, Janet has remained a regular Avenger, serving with the Avengers Unity Squad and later the Avengers Agents of Wakanda initiative. And then since 2016, she's kind of been pushed to the side by the popularity of the new Wasp, which is Nadia Van Dyne. However, Janet's still around, even embracing Nadia as a family and helping mentor her.
They deal with some of that. There was a Wasp miniseries in 2022.
Okay.
I came to it late, I guess. That's when I found out about Nadia.
Yeah. I found out some random issue. I'm like, what is this? Who is this? What's going on? There's been a lot of series, or miniseries, I should say, called either Ant-Man and Wasp or whatever. I don't know. Am I right in saying there's never been a book just called The Wasp? Is that fair to say? That's about her, I should say.
Well, the miniseries is about her. I think it did come out in the wake of the Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Probably, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. And that's worth mentioning as well. Obviously, Janet Van Dyne is now part of a billion-dollar blockbuster industry as a movie star played by Michelle Pfeiffer in the MCU movies.
All right, we're ready. Let's look at Marvel Team-Up number 60. Here's how it's fronting. Let's look at that cover by Al Milgram, of all people. I shouldn't say of all people, because he did tons of covers at Marvel in the era. What do you think of this one?
There's a lot of words on this cover, okay? And I mean a lot of words. So you've got Marvel Team Up in the top left-hand corner. Then you got Marvel Comics Group, approved by the Comics Code Authority. And you got 30 cents, issue 60, August. Then giant block letters, Marvel Team Up, trademark, featuring Spider-Man, registered, and the Wasp, all block letters. Then it says, a matter of love and death. And then there's word balloons. I mean, there's just a lot of reading on the, and it's all in the top third, too, which is the part that's sticking up at the comic rack. So if I was a kid looking at the spinner rack, other than the little Spider-Man at face in the corner box, I don't know this comic's selling much. Either way. Once you get into it, so the setting is some area with a bunch of machinery that you're not really sure. It's all just kind of in gray. And Spider-Man is in a brawl with this big, hulking, burning creature who's got, like, you know, kind of horns over his eyebrows. And he's burning like the Human Torch is burning, but his legs look like they're made of crystal or ice, perhaps. And they are just clocking Spider-Man. And this guy is saying, I already murdered Yellowjacket. Now you two will be next to freeze and burn in the grip of Equinox, the thermodynamic man. And then the more interesting thing is in the foreground, in the bottom right-hand corner of the panel, of the cover, is Wasp. She's pretty large on the screen, so you know you're close to her, because remember, she's shrunken. You can see her wings. She's zapping at Equinox, and there's lots of different things in the foreground that are very, very large to help reinforce that she's tiny. So there we go. That's the cover. I've been talking for a bit. Why don't you start, and then I'll chime in.
Okay, well, one of the things I like here is the soft number two pencil that's in frame.
Okay.
Well, it's the equivalent, I had to check, because I don't think we use pencils like that, right? So it's the equivalent of HB, if that's your scale for lead pencils.
I don't know. What do you mean by that? What is HB? What are you talking about?
Okay, I guess you use soft number two. It would be like when you buy pencils. There's a scale of softness and hardness to pencils. And HB is kind of a middle, it's like the first soft pencil.
Okay.
I guess it's the second soft pencil, according to this.
See, over here, we always had to use, all of us growing up, everyone knows what a number two pencil is, because we had to use it for Scantrons in school.
Right. So you had numbers.
Yes.
We had HB, and then you had like 2H would be like harder, and like H is hardness, I guess, and B is black. So you had like a 2B pencil would be very black, and a 2H pencil would be very hard. And if you went like a 3 or 4H, you'd be sure to rip through your piece of paper because it's just too hard. So anyways, the more B it is, in your case, the more soft it is, the blacker it is. And when I think of Al Milgram, I feel like this is a minimum softness / blackness.
Oh, because he uses the such thick lines? Okay.
Yeah, so it feels like this is almost like a signature to put the number two pencil in there.
Oh, that was a long way to explain that. Okay.
Well, I mean, because I guess Canadians, we don't have the same scale for our pencils.
Same
I didn't think I needed to explain it.
Who knew you were going to get a Canadian to, you know, international pencil education lesson here, folks?
I bet the U.S. is the only one using numbers and everybody else uses H and B.
Does any measurement scale we use over here make sense to anyone else in the world? No.
I guess then, yeah. Anyway, it's always fun to see small things made big in comics, right?
We
love Batman running around on a typewriter, that kind of stuff. So putting the Wasp in that perspective, I think is fun. The big clicky switches and everything. So I like that foreground better than the background, really, which is Equinox beating up Spider-Man. It's like, no.
I agree completely. The foreground with Wasp, first of all, she's always hot, but it is much more interesting because, like you said, the scale. It reminds me of the Doctor Who Planet of the Giants. You know, just when you have something huge, like those toggle switches. It's interesting. When you said toggle switches, all I can see are the game pieces from the game Sorry. That's what they look like to me, if you've ever played Sorry. But anyway, big toggle switch is what you got there. Equinox definitely looks like he's clocking Spider-Man hard. Like, Spider-Man's head is like, whoa, been knocked over sideways.
And look at those fists. They're huge.
He's got hams on the end of his fist. That's what he's got there.
Gigantic fists.
And I mentioned earlier, like, there's a lot of words. I'm like, I'm not kidding, guys. It's a lot. And the word balloons are ridiculous. I do love a word balloon on a cover. So I do love it. But Equinox, like, saying his own name, Equinox, the third thermodynamic man, is just funny to me. Because, like, if I were to reread this quote, like, it'd be something like, I've already slandered Ryan Daly. Now you and Chris Franklin will be next to feel the sick burn of Shag, the irredeemable podcaster. Like, I'm not going to talk like that. Here's a thought. Al Milgram, it's a perfectly serviceable cover, right? It's not terrible. It's not fantastic either, but it's perfectly serviceable. If you've got John Byrne drawing the inside, why on earth would you put Al Milgram on the outside?
I don't know what's happening there. So they probably had a deal, like a contract, so many covers during the year, or had that editor's office or something that made this happen.
Maybe.
Because we know John Byrne is a very quick artist.
Yeah. And he's already well enough known. He's been drawn for Marvel for a while now, so.
Yeah, and he's doing the interiors, and we know he can do 2 books a month.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Why are you doing the covers? I can only imagine some sort of side deal. I've read enough comic book tell-alls to realize that there's stuff like that happening. It's like throw a bone to your friend Al Milgram, or you had a deal with Al Milgram, you know, to give him so much work. So he's going to be doing the covers, and he does a lot of covers in this era, so maybe he had just, you know, like a package deal.
He's about to take that taxi ride up the street to DC Comics, because just a few short months after this, he's got the Firestorm designs on his drawing board. So, and I believe at that time, I think he left Marvel to go work for DC. I don't think he was doing, well, geez, I shouldn't say that. I'm probably wrong.
No, I think you're wrong, because like he did like the first issues of ROM Space Knight, which is after this.
Okay. All right, maybe he's doing work for both.
I think
he
played both sides.
Okay, all right. Well, he's definitely going to be working for DC. It's just as a Firestorm guy, it's just neat to think that a couple months later, Firestorm's designs. I mean, you know, drawing this guy right here on this cover could have influenced him drawing Firestorm. For all we know, the guy's on fire.
Yeah, definitely. I think Firestorm's the better design.
Just a tad.
Not that it's his fault. He didn't design Equinox.
True. Very true.
All right. Well, let's open up this comic. And here's a quick synopsis. It's called A Matter of Love and Death. It's written by Chris Claremont with art by John Byrne and Dave Hunt. Despite her rage, the Wasp can't put a dent into her husband's killer Equinox, so she, Spider-Man, and the villain's mom fly to the Baxter Building for help. No one's there, but they still use Reed Richards' lab to create a harness that will sap his powers. The Wasp discovers her own powers have been increased. And Yellowjacket shows up alive at the end to put the harness on Equinox. Then he explains Janet's power boost is her birthday gift, triggered by her grief.
We're going to talk about that.
we'll get into the details as we go into the issue itself.
A couple of big picture things, too, before we get page by page. Claremont here. Interesting. I did look it up on Mike's Amazing World. He is writing 4 comics a month at this point. Marvel Team Up, X-Men, Iron Fist, which in a later transition to Power Man, and Ms. Marvel. And this continues as a trend all the way into the 80s and into the late 80s. Like, you know, he's writing X-Men and New Mutants. Oh, gosh, a bunch of... Anyway.
The other X-Men.
Well, kind of, sort of, yeah. So, yeah, he will continue to write 4 books a month for a long time, which is crazy considering how many words he crams into a comic. That's a lot of writing. So I want to mention that. I also want to mention Dave Hunt as the inker. I'll be honest, I didn't even notice Dave Hunt's name until you said it 30 seconds ago. The inking here, like, there's no doubt this is a Byrne comic. You look at it, the lines are clean. It looks like Byrne. I mean, it looks like early Byrne. But either way, Dave Hunt did a really great, and like, that's not an inker I'm familiar with, but he did a really great job making sure not to lose the Byrne of it, you know?
Some people are chameleons, and they really, to me, it must mean that the pencils were pretty fixed, you know, not loose at all. Some people are better anchors to certain artists than others, you know.
Yeah, I'm just surprised I don't remember this guy's name.
Just a jobber.
Could be, yeah.
We don't know his style. He's not like a, who am I thinking of on X-Men with John Byrne, right?
Yeah. Terry Austin would be his
Terry
name.
Terry Austin, yeah. Right. Terry Austin, very distinctive. It's still Byrne, but you can tell it's Terry Austin.
Yeah.
I think Dave Hunt is maybe more of a, he doesn't show his style on people's pencils. In any case, the first page, where everybody's like kind of crowded on that splash, Jean DeWolf shows up, the captain of the police. So it's a weird transition for me between issues. We're 5 minutes later, the cops have arrived, they put up barricades, the superheroes are taking a break, Equinox is gloating on top of burning wreckage. His ice pants aren't even melting or anything, but a lot of stuff happened in between issues.
Right.
One of those things is not the superheroes fighting Equinox for another 5 minutes.
I didn't even think about it until I read your note, because, you know, it made sense when I was reading it. But yeah, you're right. Like, Equinox just had to, like, stand there patiently, you know, like, almost like during, I don't know, set up for a concert. Like, the roadies come in, you know, and put up the police barricades, and all these things had to happen. And Equinox is like, no, go ahead, guys, take your time. It's fine. No worries. I can wait. I got time. You know, it's just ridiculous that they all stood there and did nothing while all this happened.
You fan of Jean DeWolf?
Well, I mean, there's the thing with her. Like when I first saw her, I was actually taken aback. Because, like, when I think of her, all I think of her is her death. I mean, I've read very few comics where she's alive. She is, in my opinion at least, unfortunately, another Spidey female character that's made more famous by her death, which is not a good look, Spider-Man writers. I'm just saying.
Is it just her and Gwen?
Or
you can name others? I mean, they're big ones. They're tentpole ones.
Those are pretty huge. I mean, first of all, like, Jean DeWolf had her own trade paperback named after her before trade paperbacks were a common thing. So, like, I remember selling it in my comic shop in the 90s before trades were common, and that was, like, a big deal. Everyone knew who she was, and, of course, obviously Gwen. There's probably others I'm not thinking of, but those are the two most high-profile ones, I would think.
Well, what I find interesting is that on the second page, she calls for her special weapons team to move into position. It's like, move over, heroes. It's like, the cops are here. And it's like, oh, this is, she kind of feels like the inspiration for Maggie Sawyer in John Byrne's Superman books.
Oh, she could be.
Like, the female a police captain. She's got a special, like, what is it? The Metropolis Special Crimes Unit.
MCU. No, that's not right. No, you're right.
Special Crime, MSCU.
Yeah.
Kind of feels like, you know, when Byrne is like, okay, I'm gonna create new characters for my Superman comics.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's DNA in common between Jean DeWolf and Maggie Sawyer.
Could be. Somewhere I've had a conversation with someone who told me who Maggie Sawyer is based on, and maybe it was Jean DeWolf. I can't remember. Someone's writing in the letters, in the comment section for us right now, and I thank you for that, by the way, whoever you are. Whoever you are, yeah. Tim Price.
But the Wasp says, shove it, and, you know, she's going to attack Equinox. She's going to try to attack Equinox again, and, you know, she's outmatched at this point. Spider-Man has to save her, and so on.
There's a lot of Spider-Man and various people calling people Mrs. in this book, like, you know, Mrs. MRS. Like, Jean DeWolf calls Janet Ms. Pym. Spider-Man calls her Ms. Pym. Later, they talk to Ms. Sorensen and all that. And, you know, it's a little strange to keep calling people by the formal name. And when you think about Janet being Ms. Pym, like, did she ever actually take Hank's last name?
I don't know.
I've always known her as Janet Van Dyne, right? I mean,
no, I think she was Janet Pym.
Okay.
At some point.
Maybe she was. Okay.
You know, after the wedding or whatever. For most of our reading, we were Janet Van Dyne readers.
Yeah, true.
Because they were already broken up.
And at this point, though, wouldn't they be calling her Ms. Pym anyway? Because they think she's a widower?
Yeah, well, they're not processing it.
I guess so.
Don't salt the wound. He just died. You're going to call her Ms.?
Yeah, I'm just saying.
This is a rare one, though, isn't it, on page two, where she zaps Equinox, but she's in full size. It's like, she doesn't shrink down.
Right.
And she's using her stings. I always thought that the stings only worked when she, or appeared, or whatever, when she was small.
That's what I thought, too. Yeah, I thought that with the wings and the stingers were part of the shrinking, I thought. And I guess maybe after this issue, it kind of is. I don't know. Because right now, the stinger's not very powerful, as we will see. That's different later in the issue.
They're going to need another plan, because, you know, obviously, he's already beaten them, killed one of them. The lady who is his mother,
Dr. Sorensen,
her gun didn't do anything.
Yep.
She shot him, right?
Yep.
Or did she? Not yet. So
I feel like she did and it didn't work. Well, I don't know.
Maybe she's going to have to do it again.
It definitely happens here. So here, like, Wasp, you know, she jacks Dr. Sorensen by the shirt. She's like ready to punch her and saying, you know, you're responsible. That boy's your killer and all that. And Spider-Man verbally leaps to Dr. Sorensen's defense, saying, no, can't you see Dr. Sorensen's as much agony as you, Janet? And I'm like, really? I mean, Janet's husband just got murdered, you know, and Dr. Sorensen's, well, her son's gone rogue, but she's got a plan. And by the way, Spider-Man, you've only talked to Dr. Sorensen for a couple of conversations, like, super short here. I think Spider-Man's underselling it a little bit. I mean, I would then turn around and jack him and be like, dude, my husband's dead.
What do you know about agony, mister?
Well, okay, so yeah.
Who have you ever lost?
Janet says that to Spider-Man, and, you know, in his head, he's thinking Gwen. He's very, like, very sad about that. Meanwhile, you know, it's got to be, like, off-panel, up in heaven. Uncle Ben's looking down like, really? Gwen's your go-to? The girl that was around for, like, a year or two, and I'm the guy who raised you for 16 years? Why is it not the same? It's his fault for both of them.
Gwen is just the latest is not even that close to this, the date of this comic, considering, well, the Wasp doesn't know, so she, you know, she's being cruel, but she doesn't know it. But also, Spider-Man is not thinking of the right people. It's like the most famous death in his life. Yeah. His Uncle Ben.
Exactly.
Let's try that gun again. Let's recalibrate or whatever. And now he's Equinox is no longer on the big burning pile of rubble. He's just smashing cars. The guy's out of control.
That's a great picture when the gun doesn't work. But there's a great picture in the bottom left-hand corner of that panel where, I mean, that really sets him apart from other flaming people or other people with like beast-like horns or whatever. It's a good, interesting, scary, demonic look for him.
I think it looks like, you know, like those Japanese masks, like the ninjas wear or something. Kitty Pryde and Wolverine. I don't know. It has an Asian look to culturally.
Yeah.
They're never going to beat this guy. The gun doesn't work. Maybe again, maybe for the first time. So they race to the Baxter Building. Hey, this is a famous location.
Yeah. Well, first, I like that Spider-Man acknowledges that raw power isn't going to win the fight, right? He says that they need to think through the situation. So I'm glad they spelled that out. It's pretty insightful for a superhero comic, not just like, we've got to figure out how to do this. He specifically says, we're going to have to use our brains, which is good. And yeah, the Baxter Building, very nice. I do wonder about this. All right, so you've got the Baxter Building, and then next issue, I mean, just pulling back the curtain, we're going to have Human Torch. I wonder if Byrne asked for this. Like, you know, a lot of times a writer and artist will work together and they say, what do you want to draw? You know, whatever. And I wonder if he asked, like, specifically for those things. Because obviously, when we think about Byrne, he's so connected to the FF. Like, maybe he was already, like, a huge fan and was dying to draw them.
Yeah, we're not too far from him doing some loose issues.
Mm.
I know he did, like, a few before, even just as an artist, and then a few as a guest writer and artist before he actually took over the book. So, yeah, this is around the end of the 70s. So it makes sense because in terms of the logic of that the characters are using, it's like we can't go to Avengers Mansion because nobody's home. But they go to the Baxter Building where there's nobody home either.
Well, she specifically said that the Avengers lab is being rebuilt. So, yeah, they can't go to the Avengers lab. So they got to find a different lab.
I'm very surprised there's no editor's note to tell us why the lab has been destroyed or something. But, you know, usually it's very tight continuity.
Right.
While they swing to the building, we get the origin of Equinox, of his mom. It's a story that mirrors what will happen, I guess, to Jen and Hank in a couple years.
Man.
It's pretty upsetting. But there was, in the home, there's the same kind of abuse.
What?
The dad is a scientist, and it's not going well, and he slaps her around, you know?
Is this just, like, what the 70s was like? Or is it just Marvel's focused on domestic violence? Like, it's you see that, and nowadays, I guess, it's like taken immediately out of the comic, like, whoa, you know, kind of thing.
Maybe it's just like awareness was building on this topic. It's like today, you wouldn't be amiss to read a comic, and it's about problems about AI, or it's about, you know, the abuses of the top 1%, or climate change would be like something in the comic, in the background of the comic. We wouldn't be too surprised to see that now. I mean, I've read a couple comics this week, and it's like, those problems did come up.
Yeah, trying to raise awareness. Yeah, that could
right.
be.
So raising awareness in the 70s. What are you raising awareness about?
Yeah,
domestic abuse. Well, you know what? I watched a lot of sitcoms and dramas back in the 70s and early 80s. Yeah, I think that this is one of those after school special issues. You know,
and you know what? Thank goodness they did raise awareness on it. So by the time we grow up, it's something that's not even something we think, you know, we're going to tolerate in any way, shape, or fashion.
I mean, we don't know that it's going to happen to Jan and Hank,
True. But
it happened to her. So that's part of the story. What do you think of this whole transformation into the accident that turns him into Equinox and so on?
First thing I got to say real quick, I've already called out to him once. I don't mean to do it so much. Sorry, he's going to get a big head. But Dr. Sorensen teaches at Bard College. So another shout out to Tim Price. So there we go. He's got a child that goes to school there.
Okay.
Now, the transformation. Poor kid. So this little kid, he's a teenager. He wants to help his dad who's trapped in the basement or wherever. And it goes down into this burning lab to go help his dad. He's trying to do the right thing by his dad. He's trying to be the hero. And unfortunately gets zapped by all this energy, which looks great. He's soaked with this purple energy. He's ripping out of his clothes, Hulk sort of thing. And then next thing, he's half transformed into like on fire and ice. And the expression on his face is horrific. Just looking at his mom saying, help me. It's horrifying. It's really disturbing. It's very, very effective. And then you get to see the six head transformation of him back and forth between fire and ice. And then like those weird horn things that, again, make him look like Hank McCoy, the Beast, grow on his head. And it's really, really well done.
Yeah. That panel also has like fire on one end and then ice coming on the other, just as like background elements.
Didn't even notice that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very cool. It's tragic. And so we get a sense that he wasn't a bad person, but energies flowing through him have driven him insane.
Right.
He's that kind of villain that you think is at least sympathetic. He's not in control of what he's doing.
Power makes people mad. I mean, just look at Ryan Daly.
I mean, we gave him too much.
Yep, we sure did. You know?
We tried to warn the others.
They wouldn't listen. They wouldn't listen.
Next up, well, we get to the Baxter Building, and I think John Byrne is already very comfortable drawing it.
Yeah,
it's going to loom large in his career.
Yeah.
It rebels against the heroes, the building itself, right? After a reboot. So she shows her card, her Avengers card. It lets her into the building. Everything's fine. But, you know, Equinox is doing damage to the city. It causes a blackout and is going to force the Baxter Building to reboot. And when it reboots, it kind of goes against the heroes. It seems like a design flaw in the Baxter Building.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, when the supervillain is in a battle, takes out the New York power grid, it makes sense to me. Like, they show a whole section of New York goes black because something got zapped, and I think that should happen more often. Like, you know, I was actually at the Newark airport in the year 2003 when there was a massive blackout on the East Coast. I've got lots of crazy stories about the Newark airport and my friends in New York at that time.
It happened twice on the Marvel team-ups that we have covered.
What?
It's in the Cannonball. It's in the Cannonball issue as well.
There's a power outage in that one?
Well, it's the big electric monster man is the villain.
Oh, yeah.
And he overloads the grid, and there's a similar blackout. So it's happened twice on our shift, but only once to date, because obviously the Cannonball issue is in the future.
I should pay more attention to what we cover quarterly.
But yeah, so the reboot, which I absolutely do not believe Reed Richards' labs are plugged into the Manhattan power grid.
Really?
Okay. It should have its own power source. The guy is running portals to the negative zone and all sorts of stuff. If it doesn't have its own dedicated power, which is probably like a tiny black hole in the basement, I mean, the drain on the city would be incredible.
I just figured the generators would kick in when he needs the extra power, but okay. I mean, you know, I don't know that you need, you know, the generator to power the stove. I mean, I don't need, like, you know, a nuclear power plant to power the stove. You use the grid for that.
Well, as I was reading this, I thought, well, this is a little, like, hiccup in their quest to get to the lab and so on. So I thought, a bit of padding. But it's going to turn out to be pretty important to the Wasp story. She gets separated from the others. So she's alone. They're in the lab, and she's alone fighting the security systems. And she's going to make some discoveries about herself there.
True. And when they get separated, it's actually one of the things I liked. They're all running together. Dr. Sorensen, Spider-Man, and Wasp. And they run into one lab, and Wasp is just a little bit behind him. And the door slams at her face in the bottom corner of their panel. And I like the effect they've done. Like, the door, you see the door slamming together with, like, a little bit of energy, you know, kind of showing in the art. But the word slam with the door is actually split. Like, it's S-L-A, and then the door slams, and on the other side of the slam is the M for slam. It's just a way to bisect it. It looks really kind of cool.
I like it, too. And the wing is, like, kind of cutting through
exactly.
It in a way. Yeah. It's the Wasp going through vents, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, but she finds it. Well, yeah, of course. And she's going to find her own way to the lab, and she's got the powers for it. But she realizes, oh, no, like, these grates, there's no way I can pull these out or whatever. She still tries. And she finds out that she's super strong at this size. Like, she's even maybe even stronger than she would be at full size, or at least the same, right?
Yes. I mean, she pulls on it. And at first, I thought something was wrong with the grid because it pulls so easily in her grip. And but yeah, we'll find out that she's stronger than she knew.
So this is the power boost that we mentioned earlier. I mean, that page where she's flying through the grating afterwards, I like that cutaway where she's, you know, you see her following some tunnels inside all of the machinery. So I like that cutaway. And the off switch that she's going to turn off the security systems. It's not like the big, like the big clunky switches on the cover at all. It's just like a button. And she doesn't realize it, but she turns off the security system, and that allows Equinox to climb up the building and come up to attack them.
Except, how did he know they were even there?
Well, you see him earlier I don't know. He just seems to be attacking the cops, right? It's not like he notices.
He has no idea where they are. Unless, like, if one of the cop radios had said, you know, like, oh, they've gone to the Fantastic Four building. But no, he just shows up at the Fantastic Four building, starts tearing into it, knowing they're already there.
The cops could have been complaining. It's like the superheroes left us, you know, or hopefully they can get the Fantastic Four or something.
I don't know.
No, maybe he's got a sense. He knows where his mom is at all times.
He's a mama's boy.
Well, definitely a mama's boy, as per the story. To Spider-Man's credit here, I mean, I don't know. I thought Sorensen would be more active in the creation of the harness that they build, but it all seems like the Spider-Man's just, I'm going to modify. Look, your tech sucks. I'm going to modify it and make it, like, useful.
Well, to be fair, he does say that she was on the right track. She just underestimated the raw power. So, I mean, he's starting with her design. So we're only, but you're right. We're only seeing him do the work. We're not seeing the fact that she worked hard on building this gun to start with. We're just seeing him do the changes with whatever the hell those welding goggles are that he's wearing.
Oh, yeah. I wish we'd seen him on his face and then he would pull it back.
He is pulling it back, though. You see those padded fingers. He's pulling it up off his face. It looks like a quilted sleep mask that somebody would wear when they're going to bed.
Yeah, it's weird. And it's just like he's wearing on top of his head. It's like that beaded thing that the fish people give Picard in Star Trek Insurrection.
Oh, my gosh.
It's very silly.
I can only assume, because it is such a strange design for welding goggles, that I have to assume that Byrne is drawing a legit Fantastic Four device, like something Kirby drew as like maybe, you know, Reed or Ben were wearing his goggles is what I'm assuming is happening here.
Well, he's enough of a fan of Kirby for that to be true.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know if anyone knows. Let us know, because this looks very dumb.
Yeah.
And it's only like two panels. And we didn't even need it. True. I mean, he's wearing screens in front of his eyes already.
Or salt shakers, if you believe the 70s. But anyway.
Equinox shows up. Boom. Through the wall.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And then Spider-Man has the harness, you know, that could sap his energy. But he doesn't use it.
What's he do instead?
Well, I mean, maybe he needs to subdue him. It's like, I can't put this thing on him until I subdue him first. So I'm going to punch him. In the previous issue, he was punching at Equinox and either burning his hand or breaking his fingers on the ice jaw, depending on where the fire and the ice were.
Mm-hmm.
So he sprays some webbing on his hands to create boxing gloves, fireproof gloves. And he starts punching with that. So he doesn't get burned or anything, but it hardly works. And he gets his block knocked off, much as it happens on the cover.
I really like the gloves. I think it's very smart. But yeah, that punch from Equinox looks super painful. It's just the way Byrne has done it. Like it's at like a, you know, Batman 66, 45 degree angle. And Spider-Man is just being clocked and sent towards the reader. And Equinox is just an uppercut. It looks painful.
We kind of mocked Equinox last time, but here it's like, I think like the powers seem more dangerous, you know, like on the next page, Spider-Man swings a big piece of tech at him and it kind of melts as it hits.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. And then, you know, he turns around, even though he's got a flaming hand, he's shooting ice and trapping Spider-Man in an ice straitjacket and he keeps hitting him. So he seems more dangerous even than in the previous issue where I know he killed a hero, but here he seems, I don't know, more powerful or more frenzied, or maybe Byrne is just drawing it cooler.
Well, I think they just did a better job displaying the character this time. Last time he did feel like a Marvel team-up reject villain. This time he feels like a legitimate threat. So I think they've just done a better job building it up.
Next page, Yellow Jacket shows up. He's alive!
Giant silhouette too. So he's like lit from the back. He's glowing, he's hands on hips, very, you know, super heroic. He shows up. It's a pretty cool silhouette there. That's a good deal.
I agree.
But what does he say, though? Wash shows up and says, Spidey, I'm back. Sorry it took so long. But Hank! Then Yellow Jacket says, and I quote, "Don't ask questions, honey. Just do as I say. Let Equinox have it with everything you've got. Let me tell you, Siskoid, the kind of fallout that would happen in my house if I said to my wife, don't ask questions, honey, just do as I say. Yeah. I would be the world's quickest single man in history."
Oh, it's very Mad Men, isn't it?
I guess so.
I had flashbacks of Reed Richards saying this to Sue all the time in the 60s. It's that kind of thing where we don't, and I understand the function. In the comic, they don't want to reveal quite yet what's happening.
Yes.
They want to do a reveal later, or they don't want to repeat information that we already know, you know, stuff like that. but the optics are always, the brainy scientist is always a man in these comics. And so he's telling his partner, the woman, shut up and sting.
I'm just telling you.
Don't ask questions, you know.
It could have been rewritten as reunions later. Give Equinox everything you've got, honey. You know,
right.
That's all it would have took. Instead of don't ask questions,
don't ask
Hunter,
questions.
Just do as I say.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Wow.
I agree with you. I mean, I don't know if Jen's noticed, but...
everyone else has.
No, I mean, she's become stronger, faster, has more stamina. Her sting is more powerful ever since Hank died.
Yep.
I think that's a sign, honey.
Well, why don't you explain it to the audience at this point? What's going on?
I mean, when she shoots Equinox, it actually hurts him. And she's like, what? And as it turns out, Yellow Jacket, now we can explain, that it was a birthday gift for her. That he modified her, he slipped her a Mickey, and he modified her powers without her knowledge as a birthday gift. He's so dreamy. So that's all part of the same thing we're talking about, right?
let me mess with you at a genetic level without your permission. Happy birthday. Wow.
I mean, to be fair, she was complaining about her low power levels.
True.
That he had given himself a boost and she didn't get a boost. So the only reason that it is just manifested, like at the beginning of the issue, she didn't have this. It's because her grief, he was supposed to slip her a dose of a synthetic adrenaline that would do it. So probably it would have been like, hey, here's your gift. And she would have gone, what the hell is this test tube? It's like, oh, it's a synthetic adrenaline. Drink it and you'll see, you know, boom, she's got more powers. But he'd never had a chance to tell her. So she found out in the heat of action.
Dude, last issue, she was literally trying to get you in the sack. That would have been enough adrenaline to make it happen. I'm just saying.
I don't know. Maybe he's kind of lame in bed. I don't know. I don't know. I don't make those determinations. I have a hot squad to do that for me.
Fair enough.
But yeah, he's only going to tell her all of this, of course, once they do deal with Equinox. And the thing that Spider-Man never did, now Hank does. I mean, maybe they needed him subdued and that sting does push him back or something. And that's enough. You know, Hank puts the harness on him. I guess he's figured everything out.
Right. Well, I mean, Spider-Man does say, slap that stabilizer across Noxie's shoulders fast. Yeah.
Right. We get another broken sound effect here, right? The Yarg is also chopped in the middle.
It looks great, though. I mean, he's sort of in all white, but he's accented with this sort of lime green. And he's clearly enraged and, you know, in pain and anger. And then they've got Kirby crackle of like magenta around him. It's a really striking panel. It really is when he's neutralized. So I think that's pretty cool.
And once he is neutralized, well, we get a chance to all explanations, which do include not only why does Jan have better powers, but how Hank survived. So last time, my guess was that I was wondering, can he shrink down to microscopic size, where he would, you know, go down into the microverse almost in between atoms? He would have survived an explosion in there because the particles would have been a lot of space between particles. Not quite. He only can shrink or shrank to, he says, infinitesimal, which whatever. But he was so light at that size that he rode the shockwaves away from ground zero, but it did knock him out. So he was out of action for a little while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it makes it works.
No, he survives. Like a leaf on the wind.
We knew he was going to anyway. So all right. So going back a bit, where Hank's the one who puts the neutralizer on Equinox, like that wasn't satisfying for me. Like, I feel like it should have been Spider-Man who put the equalizer, you know, whatever the thing on there, or maybe Equinox's mom, or even Wasp. Like, Yellow Jacket's like fourth in line for me for who should have been the one to neutralize this guy.
Yeah, it should have been one of the two starring heroes. I'm sorry, Yellow Jacket, you come in the last minute. You get to watch.
Yeah, exactly. And really, they don't even resolve the Equinox problem. It's just temporary, as near as you can tell from the way they're saying it. It's just we've stopped him for the moment. So, like, are they going to get this kid back to normal? Like, there's no indication there ever are. They're just going to take him to jail is all they're going to do. And so it just tells me, like, okay, he's coming back in Marvel Team Up in the next year.
Yeah, I think that's something that happens.
Probably.
And his mom can work on him or something, you know, whatever. But interestingly, I think I like the connective tissue here because they leave. They sort of invite him to come along.
They invite Spider-Man, you mean?
Oh, yes. Not Equinox, obviously. Yeah, they invite Spider-Man to go with them, but he decides to stay back and pick up all the trash Like, the lab has been semi-destroyed, so he cleans up, which will set him up for a team-up with the Human Torch.
Exactly.
It's actually a little mini-arc where, like, for the next few issues, like, these issues have been following one, you know, back-to-back, basically, with nothing in between.
That's kind of cool. I like that.
We shouldn't also possibly mention the hook for the next issue, the carved wand.
That's what they call it, but it just looks like a bunch of cubes stuck together to me. But
yeah, there used to be, like, remember when the craze with the Rubik's Cube and there was like a bunch of other puzzles?
Looks like the snake or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, there was like a snake one, and that's what it looks like. We'll see.
If I've read the issue, I have no recollection. So when I saw this, I'm like, I have no idea what that is, but that's clearly a clue for next issue.
Yeah, it fell out when he ripped the thing off.
Yeah.
You saw it fall out to like knock out of the... So maybe it's like an ancient enemy and, you know, from an earlier fight in Fantastic Four history, you know, it'll be a problem coming up. General note on the art here, not as many huge splashes as last time. I think there's just more story.
That's a good observation. Yeah, because you're right. Byrne really kind of blew up some panels last time. Yeah, you're right. This is, everything's got 6-7 panels on the page. Yeah.
So there's still some Kripal moments, but there's no like big page, you know, moments like last time, like the explosion that killed Hank or seemed to kill him. There was like big, more than half a page panels, that kind of stuff. So here, I think there's just, it's more packed. We're changing Janet's status quo. We're bringing Hank back to life. We got the origin story of Equinox. There's a lot more to it in this one.
Yeah. Other than, I'm looking at the whole thing here. Other than the first splash page, there's not a page with anything less than 5 panels. Some with 7, some with more than that. Yeah.
Any other comments before we move on?
No, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the comic. I thought it was fun. I felt like it was a better story than last time. Like, I felt like there was kind of a, I don't want to say direction, but I mean, there's, you know, I felt like I was following a big rollicking adventure, and then you get a satisfying ending where, you know, Yellow Jacket didn't die. So I feel like this one was really well put together, and the art's solid. Yeah. Like you said, it could use more splash page, more big explosions or whatever, but that's, I mean, come on, it's Claremont's writing an 18-page comic. You know, there's going to be a lot of words in here, or 17 pages, I'm sorry. Claremont shoving a story into 17 pages, that ain't easy for him, I'm sure.
I would say that a lot of people have told us that they love this story, or this was one of the, a great Hank and Janet story that they remembered. I think they're taking it as a whole.
Yeah.
The two issues. Because people were telling us this after the first issue, and it was like, yeah, I guess. Okay. It's okay. But taken in all, it's a good yarn.
But it's so tainted by Hank. It's just like changing her biochemistry without even asking. It's like, God.
Yeah, that relationship was toxic from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, the comment thread, y'all were great. By the way, we'll get to that in the feedback. Y'all were great. Bring in some more knowledge on that, too. So thank you.
All right. Who fared better, Shag? First, let's ask, how well does this issue fit each of the characters' stories or atmospheres? Is this a Spider-Man story, or is it more of a Wasp story? Because Hank's presumed death and the Wasp unlocking new powers might give her the advantage there, but you can't get to a solution without Peter Parker's science skills, so...
It feels kind of balanced as far as who had the action in this one. And Equinox does feel more like a Spider-Man foe to me. But I'm going to give it to the Wasp, though, because of the emotional motivation of the story. And when it comes down to the science, I mean, they could have just had Dr. Sorensen do it. He didn't, you know, could have been an easy fit plug-in. So yeah, I'm going to give it to the Wasp, just because.
Makes perfect sense. Cool moves! What is Spider-Man's coolest move? I'll go first here. I'll say that creating that harness. You'd think Sorensen would be more involved, honestly. But, you know, he's a science kid. And I think because he does so much like street brawling, he doesn't get to use that often enough. So it's great to see him be a scientist in this one.
I totally agree. That was great. Absolutely. I mean, really, and if you extend the science idea, him creating the webbed boxing gloves is also science. It's like, okay, I need to protect my hands. And then, you know, he's thinking it through. So those are both are cool. But since you picked the science side of it, I will just go instead with Spider-Man saving people. Like, you know, he leaps to save the Wasp early on. He later swings in to save Dr. Sorensen. So those are some good, you know, Spidey save moves.
What about the Wasps? I will go with just hulking out in the vents.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I won't say the hulking out part, but her going to the vents in the first place. I mean, deciding to go through the back ways to get where she needs to go, tackle the problem like John McClane on Christmas. So, yeah, good job, Wasp.
I mean, both heroes are shown to be smart in this.
That's true.
Like, be clever and strategic.
Yeah.
All right, but maybe they had some dumb or weird moves as well. What do you think for Spider-Man?
I mean, he makes the boxing gloves, right? And then immediately gets clobbered by Equinox. Like, you know, where's the Peter tingle here, right? I mean, that should have protected him.
Well, for me, he's got the harness, but immediately drops it to fist fight Equinox, even though that didn't work last time. I don't know. You're so acrobatic. Get behind him already.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could argue low ceiling, blah, 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 but still, come on.
Well, I will argue they wanted Hank to save the day, so you needed like a little buffer space for that.
Ugh.
What do you think about the Wasp?
Her dumb move was allowing her husband to talk to her like that. Don't ask questions, honey. Just do as I say. Very dumb move, Janet.
I mean, the one that I had is not exactly her fault because she couldn't have known or she didn't know, but turning off the security system is what allows Equinox to breach the Baxter building. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's not so much a bad, you know, dumb move on her part. That's just cuz plot.
And what about the friendly farewell? It's a team-up tradition. How does this one rate? The Spider-Man is invited to go to the police station with the Pims, hot date, but he stays behind to clean up the lab all by his lonesome.
Oh, he's very friendly. I mean, they're being nice to each other. They're patting each other on the back, congratulating each other, all that. So I think that's good. And you know, when the Pims leave for the police station, it's possible Spidey was trying to think, okay, these two thought they lost each other. Give them a chance to be alone. I don't know.
How often do you see somebody clean up their mess?
Right. In a superhero comic, right? Yeah, never.
Right. There's a friendly farewell between them, and then there's like, he's trying to be friendly to the FF, having crashed their pad.
Or he's scared of Reed, or he's scared of Ben. Or, as we said before, because plot for next
because
issue.
Yeah. Final question in this section. If this were your first Wasp story, would you seek out more? Did Marvel team up to do its job?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, she had a lot to do. Her powers were ramped up. She had an emotional journey. So yeah, some good stuff here. What about you?
Yeah, well, I like her but better than Yellow Jacket.
Okay,
that's
sure.
For sure. You know, so whether they would be partners or not, or, you know, so I think this is a good issue for her. She does a lot of action. She's smart. She's strong. And then, you know, the spoiler comes in. The husband comes in. It's like, wow. It's like you can't allow her to shine.
It's always less fun when the hot girl's husband shows up.
Always. All right, we'll take a break for a couple of promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away. During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics. Out of the pages of Rex Pym, Meta Jacket, it's Janet Stagg as the Element Queen. She and Rex have split up, and it's her turn to shine in an epic special that leads directly into Amalgam's new team book, The Asiders. Under Janet's leadership, they will face the masters of disastrous evil, and not everyone walks away from that fight. Get them while they're hot, only where Amalgam comics are sold.
All right, we're back and we're caught in the web. It's the feature where we discuss some of our favorite interactions between Spider-Man and the guest outside of the comic we just featured. What Spider-Man Wasp team-ups can we recommend? So, I thought long and hard. Spider-Man's Tangled Web number 21 from Christmas 2002 is the one I'm going to recommend by Darwin Cook.
Ooh. So,
enough said. But it's a Christmas story where Jan is doing some Christmas shopping with Sue Richards and Crystal of the Inhumans, while Reed is trying to find the missing Medusa in time for the holiday. And Peter Parker is hosting some orphans at the Daily Bugle after a snowstorm has stranded them in the city. Those two things are going to crash together. The Marvel Girls find Medusa at Macy's under the Puppet Master's control, robbing the store with a bargain basement Spider-Man. I won't tell you who it is. Just read the issue. And then the real Spidey eventually shows up to deal with the situation. Now, arguably, Jan and Peter don't have a lot of action together. She helps fight the fake Spider-Man, but Spidey fights alone at the end. But She's hilarious in this comic, and I generally love all the girls' nights that Marvel seems to be so often doing. So I'm still recommending this as my Spider-Man-Wasp combo comic.
All right. All right. I'll have to check that out. I mean, Darwin Cook, like you said, enough said. Wow. Pulling back the curtain, Siskoid was very kind to me and offered up Spectacular Spider-Man 105 and 106, which would probably have been an ideal pick for me. So thank you for that, Siskoid. But instead, I'm going to cheat. I came up with a caught in the web idea, so I guess I'm allowed to bend the rules occasionally. I'm going to pick a comic that features both Spider-Man and the Wasp, but they don't actually team up in the issue. And I'm picking it, honestly, because it's an incredibly important series to me. I mentioned it earlier. I said Secret Wars, right? I told you guys that was my first superhero comic I collected. Well, issue number 3, the issue after I started with number 2, which was my first superhero comic, that comic helped put me on a path for life, that Secret Wars series, right? And issue number 2 specifically. So in issue 3, Spider-Man, as it just shows on the cover, he beats the crap out of the X-Men, which is great. Then, meanwhile, elsewhere, Wasp pretends to be attracted to Magneto to find out his plans. So while Spidey and Janet didn't actually team up in the issue, they're both kind of battling the mutants in their own way. So I'm going to pick that one.
All right. Well, I'm legitimate.
And did I read from your notes earlier that you're suggesting that maybe her quote-unquote romance with Magneto was a little more real than she let on? Is that what you're suggesting?
I mean, Magneto's a very handsome man. All right. The bonus team up. Each of us will propose a perfect Wasp team up. And, well, I really wanted to do something for Fashion Week because of her background. So it's the Wasp and the Devil Wears Prada. You have Miranda trashing Janet's superhero chic, but they eventually join forces against Mephisto, who has corrupted a whole army of Emilys. It writes itself, honestly.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. That's a great idea. And I hadn't even thought of the fashion route. That's great. If I'd gone that route, I probably would have picked, like, The Wasp in Fashion and Action by John K. Schneider III.
Okay.
But instead, I went the high society route. So I paired Janet Van Dyne, The Wasp, with Selina Kyle, Catwoman. Mm. And it would feature some kind of, like, you know, high society gala, whatever. And Janet and Selina would meet their civilian identities. There'd be some, like, sarcastic banter. Like, clearly, they probably travel in the same circles but can't stand each other, that kind of thing. And this would all lead to Catwoman planning some kind of heist, stealing from the gala or some associated group. Then the Wasp tries to stop Catwoman. But then, you know, Clayface and the Whirlwind, they try to pull the same heist. So Catwoman and the Wasp have to stop, team up to stop the villains. That's where I would have gone.
I'd read it.
Yep.
I'd read it.
It'd be fun.
They're both like short-haired heroines as well.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
So they have like a similar fashion sense. I think it's supposed to be like a very chic haircut for the whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It makes sense for their backgrounds. Yeah. Okay, now it's time for web zingers of our own, which is to say, your feedback on our previous episode, Together, in which we covered Marvel Team-Up number 59, starring Spider-Man, Yellowjacket, and the Wasp.
All right, listen up, true believers. The comments section of the last Marvel Team-Up with Spider-Man and Yellowjacket was an astonishing success, right? I mean, that FW Team-Up episode had the most comments for that cycle and the most individual people commenting. And I mean by a lot of people. As I always say, you people are amazing, you people are spectacular, and you people are even web of. Now, I'd love to claim that it's Siskoid and mine's sparkling banter that drove the winning amount of comments, but it probably has more to do with how darn good these Claremont and Byrne comics are, I imagine. It is time to keep that wall-crawling momentum swinging, folks. Let's show the world that Marvel Team-Up was the most popular Team-Up comic and that Spider-Man fans are the best. So please share your thoughts at firewaterpodcast.com for this episode, webheads. Let's get those comments flowing and keep Marvel Team-Up on top. Because remember, with great podcasts comes great participation.
All right, why don't you start us off, Shag?
All right, we heard from Movie Matt Royce, who says, Yellowjacket, Yellowjacket. Okay, let's address the elephant in the room. Janet has long ago forgiven Hank. And if she can forgive him, who are we to keep them from moving past it? Domestic abuse is, of course, a horrible thing. When the story was written, it was an attempt to tell a story and expand the characters. And as you gentlemen pointed out, it made Janet stronger. As for Yellowjacket as a character, at the time, all I knew about him was that he was on the Marvel Superheroes lunchbox I had in kindergarten. Much like you guys, I didn't get to know Hank until West Coast Avengers.
All right, next up is Chris Lewis. Do you really want to sing the song
I really do. Are you ready? Okay. This is Dr. Chris Lewis wrote this. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a real spider can. Yellow Jacket and the Wasp, caught in his web, dissolves their internal organs. They are dead. Watch out. The shortest issue of Marvel Team-Up ever. And as Chris admits, it needs some work.
Yeah, well, it may be that you were offbeat for part of it.
You think?
Well, he also gives us a lot of thoughts on how to detoxify Hank Pym.
All right.
Proposal number one, age Hank up properly and permanently. Hank becomes an elderly statesman now, mellowed by his experiences as a costumed hero. Proposal number two, hire a skilled and sensitive female writer to work with established experts in the field of domestic violence to develop a respectful resolution story for both Janet and Hank. He says, I know from my own patients that domestic violence is something more common than is recognized, and portrayal in a fictional tale could raise awareness of both the issues and the real-world support available to those involved. This, of course, would need to be handled extremely sensitively, which is why bringing in experts in the field could help to bring new and genuine perspectives to enrich the story and give it authenticity.
That would be, I think, the absolute best choice there if it had been done 40 years ago. You know, right. Now, unfortunately, we've got 40 years of stuff that's passed since then. So I think it'd be difficult to do today unless they tell a story that's supposed to take place in the 70s or something. I don't know. But yeah, or 80s, I mean, 80s, sorry.
When it happened. Proposal number three is lean into the science. I see what Marvel are doing with their Scientist Supreme thing, but the whole idea about the scientific method is that it's a collaborative effort. One person's results need to be confirmed and corroborated by others to prove that they are true. It's not like one guy can burst in and say, I wear the lab coat of Agamotto and screw your research, what I say goes. Have Hank gather a brain trust of all the best Marvel scientists to crack difficult problems without donning spandex. So this is the West Coast Avengers, in a way, it's the West Coast Avengers scientist version.
Yeah. And actually, his proposal number one about aging up Hank permanently, I mean, that's kind of what they did in the MCU movies.
And in the comics now, he's like, he's got a white beard.
Oh, does he really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think we're there.
All right. Good options. Thank you, Dr. Lewis. Then we heard from Super Captain. It says, I think this was my first Spider-Man comic as well as my encounter with John Byrne art. I had read Claremont on X-Men just a month or so before this. Hank Pym had been the focus of my first Avengers comic, number 161, with the fantastic George Perez cover of him as Ant-Man growing to regular size and punching Cap and Black Panther while the ants scramble all over the rest of the team. He was having a nervous breakdown and mental issues in that story, so I think I had the impression that this was a central part to his character. I always liked the Yellow Jacket costume since I first saw it on my Marvel Superheroes lunchbox. Here's a reoccurring theme here, folks. Then Super Captain goes on to say, one of the most heartbreaking images and pages in comics, in my humble opinion, is in the JLA Avenger story. All the heroes are seeing bits of their future, their trials and their hardships. Superman sees his death. Hal Jordan sees himself becoming Parallax. Iron Man sees his alcoholism. Vision and Scarlet Witch see how they lost their twins. Hank sees himself smack Jan and just says quietly, oh, Jan. Absolutely gut-wrenching. Oh, wow. Busick and Perez. I mean, what? Yeah, you're going to expect the best from them.
Dr. Ange, he says the title is definitely a riff on Robert Frost's poem Fire and Ice, which is a favorite of his. As an English major, I should have said something.
Shame.
And his personal option for fixing Hank Pym is a ship that already left the harbor, which is why not make him a Skrull after Secret Invasion? It was been so much easier, but they missed the boat on that one.
Well, he mentions that he uses the term albatross here because Dr. Ange and I have actually had many conversations about comic book albatrosses because a lot of characters bear these. Like Firestorm is dealing with his right now, actually, in his monthly comic, his new miniseries, because in Doomsday Clock, Firestorm killed a bunch of people. And so he's dealing with the albatross of that right now. So it's tough in comics.
And that albatross, of course, comes from the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. So he really got like poetry on his mind.
He does. That's a deep soul there on Dr. Ange. So then we're from Eric MCI or Mickey, maybe perhaps. Either way, Eric says he points out there's a new Firestorm comic on the shelf. So thank you for that, Eric. Yes, and I'm reading it, enjoying it very much.
Sean Ross says, I love that you will cover the Claremont Byrne issues, which are highlight of the series. To my knowledge, Janet's increased power levels isn't mentioned formally until the Stern Buscema run of the Avengers, which is the best Avengers run.
I think that's what he's saying, is we don't hear about it again till then. All right.
Yeah.
Jeff R. So, like, we talked about different aliases for different characters, and did Hank Pym have more aliases than anyone else? And Jeff R. says, Dick Grayson matches Hank Pym for major aliases, but Jimmy Olsen is likely the champion there. And then he says, actually, the title probably belongs to one of the H-dial wearers, which, of course, would... Boy, you're just sucking up to Siskoid with that nonsense there, Jeff.
I don't think that counts.
Okay. I mean, those are temporary, right? Yeah. And same thing with Jimmy Olsen. Same thing with Jimmy Olsen. Most of those.
Is this a transformation?
Yeah.
All right. Ladybug, that's Jason Lady, says, in the mid-late 1980s, they reprinted the whole Claremont Byrne MTU run in Marvel Tales, and they were among the first superhero comics I ever read. I'm excited you guys are covering this run. They are fun superhero comics. I actually, some of my MTU issues are actually Marvel Tales in my collection, but very few. Then he says, the power upgrades Jan gets here were really only used in the Avengers during the Roger Stern run. After that, pretty much every writer has her tiny with an ineffectual sting. Boop, because everything has to be the way it was in the 1960s. Same with Hank and Jan getting back together, which we can blame Byrne for in his West Coast Avengers run, which was mighty regressive overall. And then at the end, he closes with, you guys were hard on poor Equinox. A guy with the powers of both Iceman and Human Torch is a serious threat, and he has a cool look. If he's lame, doesn't it follow that Johnny and Bobby are lame too? Equinox would be a good Frightful Four or Masters of Evil member. Okay. He's got a fan.
I think we're more hard on him because the issue didn't really show to his strengths, but this issue did. So there we go. Yeah. He does go on too. He took that challenge of, we said, does anyone have more identities than Hank?
Right.
And he rattled through a whole bunch of people like Monica Rambeau and Carol Danvers and Jean Grey and Kitty Pryde, exactly, Kitty Pryde and Donna Troy and Dick Grayson and all these things. It still looks like Hank's winning. So as far as we can tell.
Most people top up at 3, maybe 4. And Hank was like 6?
Well, Ant-Man.
5?
Giant-Man, Goliath, Yellowjacket, Wasp, and it depends on if you
and
count
Dr. Pym.
If you count Dr. Pym as an alias. I don't know if you really can.
I count Dr. Pym. Yeah.
You really do?
Just different costume. He was called Dr. Pym. I think that's like a different look and etc. Different identity, different powers, or different power use.
That gets to 6, and the closest Jason got with anyone else was 4. So there we go. Rob McCarthy chimes in, and he has an ideal team up. He says, of Yellowjacket and Terror Inc. Now, there's a deep cut, folks. If you don't remember your 90s Marvel comics, you probably don't even remember Terror Inc. He suggests that Terror robs Egghead's grave, and somehow he would love to work in the Golden Age Yellowjacket from Target Comics. All right, Rob.
Okay. Scott Arthur says, Jan was introduced in a story that borrowed the premise of the first Thin Man movie, big fan, in which the daughter of a murdered scientist asks William Powell to investigate the crime. The Ant-Man story combined that character with the detective's wife, Myrna Loy, to make Jan, who was drawn somewhat like Loy. So, yeah, I see it. You know, if Jan were played, like, let's imagine superhero comics, but it's all like 1930s and 1940s stars. Somehow. Myrna Loy would make a great Wasp.
You know what? It was right there in front of us. The team up should have been Janet Van Dyne and Sue Dibney. That's who should have been the team up, because they're both kind of based on the Thin Man sort of plot there. Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That would have been
yeah.
brilliant. And now I'm not going to get into this, but Scott has really outlined incredibly well. You should check this out again, firewaterpodcast.com, FW team up. He has really outlined the numerous hints that Hank was suffering mental illness. And also he identifies it as dysfunctional socialization disorder. And he outlines a whole lot of these, even with specific issues and numbers and things like that. So Scott really did his research on the breakdown of Hank. So thank you, Scott.
We're sorry we just can't read all of that on in the mailbag section.
Well, and it just goes to show that it wasn't just Hank losing his cool and hitting
the Jan. One time.
Exactly. Yeah. There was a purposeful buildup to him, you know, losing his mind there. Then we're from Bucky749, who says, do you think the Yellow Jacket was created as a tribute to the MLJ character The Fly? Well, Rob McCarthy answered for me. Thank you, Rob. He says, no, there's a 1940s Yellow Jacket. And he says, I think 1941, but I've heard 1944. All right. Well, thank you to Bucky and thank you, Rob.
Edu Bosnar says, well, guess I'm going to date myself here and say that I, for one, think Yellow Jacket is the best of Hank's many aliases, while Scott Lang kind of owns the Ant-Man identity. By the way, I love that Shag refers to Spider-Sense as Peter Tingle. Did it again this time. Sounds dirty and like something he'd experience if he happened to see Jan in her lingerie.
Oh my gosh. Now, full disclosure, I mean, I'm stealing that from Marissa Tomei saying it in the Spider-Man movies. And, you know, if we're thinking about dirty thoughts, I mean, Marissa Tomei's right there. So, all right.
Right. And it just also sounds like there is like a line of trashy ebooks by Chuck Tingle.
Oh my gosh.
It's like this crazy gay pornography with basically gonna have sex with anything. It's very strange. And he's got like billions of titles. Chuck Tingle. I mean, it's famous online. It's a famous online thing. So every time you say Peter Tingle, I'm thinking of Chuck Tingle.
I could have gone a lot longer in my life without knowing that. So I'm just saying the Peter Tingle is a great line from the MCU movies. It's funny.
Okay.
Because it is awkward. So, all right. Joe Llewellyn says, great episode. I bought that comic and follow-up when they came out. Yellow Jacket has a pretty decent design, especially when Perez or Byrne draws him. I thought he was cool. Now, Joe, I would totally agree. I mean, when Perez and Byrne draw the Yellow Jacket costume, it is as good as it's ever going to look. It looks great. It's just when you stop to think about it is when it falls apart for me. I'm like, okay, this is just ridiculous looking. But they still make it look pretty cool because they're amazing the way they draw things.
And I mean, to be fair, all the other costumes before that were sort of generic. It's like Ant-Man's got a great helmet, but otherwise, leotard. The giant man had those weird antenna, like he's still Ant-Man. It's weird. It's just like a red leotard.
Right.
Goliath is pretty generic as well. So this one was the first one that was like designed to be the theme. Gothos Mansion says, first off, I need to warn you guys about something. Don't encourage the heroes to take time off from their duties for sexy time. Sorry to spoil a comic from that is older than we are, but in Flash 192, November 1969, Iris persuades Barry to come back to bed, insisting he will make this mission since he's the fastest man alive. Well, apparently he isn't the fastest man alive at sexy time because he arrives late to this mission and people died.
Ooh.
Okay.
All right. Relationships are hard.
Yeah. And another fan for Equinox, because he says, y'all have been a little rough on Equinox. He is cooler, or at times hotter, than some lame Spider-Man villains who went on to have more substantial careers, like Hammerhead and the Grizzly.
Hammerhead's kind of a big deal. That's a surprising
that's
one
what
to,
I thought.
To throw into the bus, but okay. Yeah, all right.
Magia leader.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, from Martin Gray, it says, I remember buying this issue at the time and rather enjoying it. Hank and Janet were favorites. It's terribly misspelled with a U. So weird, Martin. Anyway, Hank and Janet were favorites from the Silver Age because, you know, English, right?
It looks fine to me.
Right, I know. Hank and Janet were favorites from the Silver Age reprints in the UK Avengers Weekly. I didn't find the villain Equinox limp. He had interesting powers and they seemed at a rather high level. So again, we've come around on Equinox on the second part of the story, everybody. So
yes. Yeah. But tell me, Martin, do you use an HB pencil?
Oh my goodness. then he says, Yellow Jacket could shrink, and that's when the flappy bits vibrated to allow him to fly. Martin, make no mistake, we understand how the costume works. We just thought it was stupid. There's a distinct difference there. And I'm not knocking other people for liking it. You like what you like, and that's okay. I like a guy with puffy sleeves and his head's on fire. I mean, we all like what we like, and that's okay. He looks doofy to me. Anyway, he says, I love the Scientist Supreme bit. It was just a bit of fun for a while. There we go. All right, Martin, always a joy to hear from you, my friend.
The Power Mad Ryan Daly says, the interesting thing about Hank and Jan as a couple is that they're not interesting as a couple. They're much better as ex-spouses, full of angst and emotional scar tissue over their failed marriage, but not shackled by it. As you said, Jan became a much more proactive, confident, and competent team member once she left Hank. And one of my favorite issues of Avengers is 224, where Jan starts to date Tony Stark unaware at the time that he was Iron Man. And then Ryan dissects Hank's breakdown even more than we did, but ends with a too long, didn't read blurb. He says, it's possible to do a terrible thing and not be a terrible person.
That's some good insight. John Stibe writes in and says, I love this episode, Shag and Siskoy, but I'm also a fan of Hank Pym as Yellowjacket. So what do I know? I'm not afraid to admit that I'm a fan of Hank Pym in many of his personas. One of my favorite early Avengers comics was issue 161, where the team is being, quote, attacked by Ant-Man. And he says, I know Hank went through a lot of trauma in his career, but I love the Ant-Man helmet and the Goliath costume with those weird goggle eyes. And yes, even Yellow Jacket's wings. Hey, you know what? Somebody's got to love them. John goes on to say, Hank was Yellow Jacket when I started reading comics. So I always kind of think of him as the character first. And hey, I mean, right. We all imprint during our golden age reading comics, yeah, which is when we fell in love with comics, really, right? Like, I imprinted on the Secret Wars era of the X-Men. I imprinted on Star Wars Marvel comics around issue 50. I mean, we all imprint on what we do, and that's okay. It makes sense. He also mentions John Byrne's amazing, beautiful artwork, as you should, because you're right. It was stunning.
Tim Price is next. He says, a small side note, as I remember that Yellow Jacket debuted in Avengers number 59, and this is MTU number 59. That can't be a coincidence. Somebody had the brainstorm to have Yellowjacket be a guest star as a nod to that, but we may never know whose idea it was. Or it may also be a coincidence. He says, the other unbelievable thing about Hank, aside from forgetting his gorgeous wife, is how buff he stays when he works in the lab all day. Look at every artist's depiction of Hank, and they all depict him as a mega beefcake. Unless Pym particles double as ripped particles, there's no way he can stay that cut. I think you're right there. I think he's like pumping Pym particles to blow up his muscles.
So either enlarging his muscles or shrinking his fat. One or the other. Absolutely. Yeah, totally. Then Nate the Great gives us our last comment. He says, this is definitely Hank as Yellowjacket's best story. Probably the most heroic he was until West Coast Avengers. Not to be insensitive, but I think the problem with Hank's big incident was Jim Shooter was trying to turn Hank into a villain, but he left the book before pulling it off. I don't think anyone who followed him liked that idea. Ah, I didn't realize that that was an effort. They were directly trying to turn him into a villain, which would be an interesting heel turn. I mean, there's a lot to be said when your hero becomes a villain. Interesting.
This is the bottom of the mailbag, so thanks for teaming up with me, Shag. Maybe you want to tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Sure. Always doing my JSA in the 90s podcast. That's my monthly dive into the Justice Society of America, as published in the 1990s. We're currently covering the 8-issue limited series from 1991, along with several spotlight episodes on various JSA members during the 1990s, including a recent one where we chatted with creators Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III about their Dr. Midnight miniseries. Then, next year, that show will transition into JSA in the 2000s, where we'll cover the much-beloved Geoff Johns era of the JSA. Then also every other month, I have a podcast entitled Marvel Star Wars from Empire to Jedi. Speaking of comics that imprinted on us, there I'm covering those classic 1980s Marvel Star Wars comics. We just covered Star Wars number 50, one of my all-time favorite comics. Then over on Once Upon a Geek, it continues to be a variety of topics, including my occasional coverage of Blue Devil or the X-Men or What If and other fun topics, whatever I feel like talking about. And we're still producing the Who's Who podcast quarterly. And we recently interviewed artist extraordinaire Chuck Patton about his work on Who's Who. And you can always find me on social media as Once Upon a Geek.
A reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content, one more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. Hey, Alan, did you go see The Death of Robin Hood? Because that's right up your alley, isn't it? We do enjoy reading your thoughts. The best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Shag is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Chris Franklin as we tackle Brave and the Bold number 68. It's an early one.
And I'll be back in 4 months with another Marvel team-up when the book returns to its roots, pairing Spider-Man with the Human Torch.
So on that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.